Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, The Management of Acute Porphyrias, Improving Diagnosis, Treatment, and Standards of Care, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Herbert L. Bonkofsky, MD, Owen M. Lander, MD, Majid K. Risk, MD, and Gail W. Grossclose, RNBSN. Dr. Bonkofsky is a professor of medicine, University of Connecticut Health Center, Farmington, Connecticut, professor of medicine, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, vice president for research, director of liver, digestive, and metabolism lab, Carolinas Medical Center, Cannon Research Center, Charlotte, North Carolina. Dr. Bonkofsky has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Clinuvel Pharmaceuticals, Lundbeck Research USA, and Novartis Pharmaceuticals. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Lundbeck Research USA. He received grants for clinical research from Clinuvel Pharmaceuticals, Novartis Pharmaceuticals, and Vertex Pharmaceuticals Incorporated. Dr. Bonkofsky does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Bonkofsky does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Lander is an emergency department physician, Morgantown, West Virginia. Dr. Lander has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Lander does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Lander does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Risk is a staff physician, Cleveland Clinic, Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Risk has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Risk does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Risk does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Ms. Grossclose is a director of clinical trials, Liver Biliary Pancreatic Center, Carolinas Medical Center, Charlotte, North Carolina. Ms. Grossclose has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Ms. Grossclose does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Ms. Grossclose does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The goal of this activity is to explore the challenges involved across specialties in identifying and managing patients with acute porphyrias. This activity is supported by Lundbeck. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello and welcome to this CME CE video roundtable panel discussion entitled The Management of Acute Porphyrias, Improving Diagnosis, Treatment, and Standards of Care. My name is Herbert L. Bonkofsky. I'm professor of medicine at the University of Connecticut Health Center in Farmington, Connecticut, and professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I also serve as vice president for research and director of the Liver, Digestive, and Metabolism Laboratory at Carolinas Medical Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. For today's discussion on the acute porphyrias, I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Owen M. Lander, an emergency room physician in Morgantown, West Virginia, and Dr. Majid Risk, a staff physician at Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio, and my colleague, Ms. Gail Grossclose, an RN and BSN, and the Director of Clinical Trials at the Liver Biliary Pancreatic Center at Carolina's Medical Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, the main goal of today's program is to explore the challenges involved across specialties in identifying and managing patients with acute porphyrias and in making the diagnosis and appropriate long-term care for these challenging patients. Just by way of general introduction, the acute porphyrias are rare metabolic disorders caused by one of four inherited enzymatic defects in normal heme biosynthesis. The four diseases have rather daunting names: acute intermittent porphyria, hereditary coproporphyria, variegate porphyria, and ALA dehydratase deficiency porphyria. The underlying cause are genetic defects in the genes that encode these enzymes of normal heme biosynthesis, and those defects may result in an overproduction of heme precursors, especially delta-aminolevulinic acid, which we will generally refer to as ALA, and porphobilinogen, or PBG. Oftentimes, there are porphyrins that also accumulate, but it's ALA and PBG that are really the key elements in both the diagnosis and in the pathogenesis of these disorders as we currently understand them. When there's overproduction, which doesn't occur in most patients most of the time, fortunately it's only a minority of people that suffer these problems, but when there is this marked uncontrolled overproduction of ALA and PBG due to a marked induction of hepatic ALA synthase, which is the first and rate controlling enzyme in heme synthesis, then there may be accumulation first in the liver, then in the blood, and then these things are over-excreted in the urine and the stool, and these remain the hallmarks for making the initial diagnosis and tipping us off that we're dealing with one of the acute porphyrias. Now, the main symptoms, the way that these people present, are usually acute attacks of pain, especially abdominal pain, although there can also be longer-term or even permanent neurologic damage if patients are not recognized quickly and treated appropriately. People often present to the emergency room during acute attacks. Indeed, they may come to the emergency room a lot of times because the diagnosis hasn't been thought of and the diagnosis hasn't been made. But there are also many that have more mild symptoms, and the recurrent attacks might be evaluated and managed by primary care physicians, by obstetricians, gynecologists, because most of these attacks occur in women. It's more often symptomatic disease in women than in men. Then, too, hematologists may see these people for either initial evaluation or more often for referral evaluation, as well as gastroenterologists and hepatologists. So this is truly a disorder that cuts across specialties. In fact, Jan Woldenström, the famous internist and outstanding physician in Sweden, called the acute porphyrias the little imitators of medicine because they could imitate so many other disorders. And it's still worth keeping in mind that when you have somebody with strange symptoms, especially somebody who keeps coming back, your index of suspicion should rise that could this patient perhaps have one of these rare acute porphyrias. So it's critical that clinicians across all these specialties and in multiple treatment settings learn how to recognize the signs and symptoms of the acute attack, how to diagnose it rapidly, and how to treat it appropriately. And with that in mind, we have put together this outstanding panel of a gastroenterologist, an emergency room physician, and a practicing nurse to discuss the challenges across the specialties in recognizing and managing patients with acute porphyrias. So I guess I'll start then with Dr. Lander. Sure. When, as a practicing emergency room doctor, do you start thinking, could this patient have acute porphyria?
It's a rare disease. We all acknowledge that. But I think you really laid it out there in the introduction. You have to start thinking about it when people have repeated presentations. As I like to say in my practice and across specialties in medicine, we've all get told, you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. My addition to that is these rare diseases are not unicorns. They're zebras. They do exist. And when you start thinking about it, typically is a third, fourth visit. In the emergency literature and other literature, there's, I think we're looking, average that time to diagnosis from the first acute onset attack in most of these patients is years. And many of them undergo therapeutic or attempted therapeutic surgeries, like gallbladder removal and so on. So typically, we wouldn't even begin to think about it in a patient until their third or fourth visit, and they've had previous maybe outpatient GI workup and analysis, scopes and so on, ultrasound. And then you start saying, hey, this is the fourth visit in 2 years, same symptom complex, 2 to 3 days of severe nonspecific abdominal pain, unimpressive physical exam, has had extensive evaluation. Before I just call this functional abdominal pain, maybe I think about pursuing it. I'd be interested to hear.
So from the standpoint of, I assume your practice is mostly a referral practice, Dr. Risk, is that?
That would be accurate. Given the fact that a significant portion of our referrals are in young females, and that the prevalence of irritable bowel syndrome is extensive in that patient population, it can oftentimes be difficult to be able to part and parcel the patients who have a porphyria, especially since porphyrias are more prevalent in females. Having said that, if a patient comes in recurrently and we do an initial gastrointestinal workup, specifically endoscopies and some sort of imaging study, and perhaps even do some empiric treatment for irritable bowel syndrome without any margin of success, then at that point I need to start considering a porphyria, especially if the symptoms are more intermittent and less chronic in nature.
What have you found to be the sort of the cardinal symptoms? Let's talk about the abdominal pain. Have you found that it's mostly upper abdominal, mostly lower abdominal, above the umbilicus or below the umbilicus?
From what we see, generally speaking, in the porphyria, we haven't noticed any specific difference in where the abdominal pain occurs. Oftentimes it can be pelvic. It's less often upper abdominal, but it can also involve the upper abdomen as well. Again, a lot of patients have abdominal pain that's chronic and present most of the time. In those cases, I think less of a porphyria, whereas patients who do have these intermittent bouts of severe abdominal pain, I may be prompted to ask further questioning whether or not it revolves around their menstrual cycle, whether or not there's any change in the urine, whether or not they've been on any recent medications that may precipitate the porphyria, to see whether or not I can increase the diagnostic yield of further testing.
And Gail, what is the unique contribution that you as a nurse or other nurses can make to try to help these people and help us as physicians to think about the diagnosis and make the diagnosis?
Well, as nurses, we often take the medical history of the patients, and we are looking for, reviewing their medical history and medications and looking for clues that would indicate the point to the porphyrias. So we're looking for medications that are unsafe for use in the porphyrias, such as the barbiturates and sulfonamides and things that maybe we could pick up on. If you all have said that they have recurring visits. So if we notice that a patient has been back for recurring abdominal pain, we might want to pick up on these symptoms and make sure that the physician is aware that there might be indication
for
porphyria screening.
I'll be the first to admit that I haven't had this diagnosis put under my nose yet by a nurse, but I've had lots of diagnoses of especially more rare things put under my nose by nursing staff in the emergency setting. Typically, because it's such a time-pressured environment, doctor contact time is limited, nurse contact is high, and often key pieces of information kind of start trickling out to the nursing staff that never made it to the physician on the initial visit. So I think that's a critical element of cooperation across the specialties that could help in pointing this us in the right direction for this recurrent abdominal pain when the harried ED doc's running around saying, looking at the charts, fifth visit, has had everything looked at, and blah, blah, blah. And maybe at some point the nurse comes and says, hey, you know, I was talking to them, and there's some features here. What about porphyria? And then I say, aha, and I do what I should do, which is exactly what Dr. Risk was talking about, which is go back and start asking some really focused, key review of system type questions. When does this happen? What kind of precipitating factors might it be there in terms of dietary changes or extreme dieting and starvation metabolism being a precipitating factor, things like that, or medication changes, people who are on barbiturates or seizure control medicines that we think could be affecting this if they've had new ones added or dosage change. All those kind of detailed questions that typically you're going to get in the clinic as an extensive full history, but I in the ED as a practicing physician often am not going to get until I get to that point of realizing maybe this is that unicorn.
Now, tell us more. You mentioned a relationship to the menstrual cycle, Dr. Risk. Expand on that a little bit more. What are the main clues?
Well, specifically in the progestins can cause or precipitate porphyrias. And so oftentimes in females during the luteal phase of their menstrual cycle will have a precipitation of their symptoms. Estrogens as well can also precipitate. And so oftentimes in patients who are diagnosed with acute intermittent porphyria who notice a relationship with their menstrual cycle, a GnRH analog may be beneficial in this patient population.
Yeah, so the key point is that, and there are women that unfortunately almost every month suffer attacks, acute attacks of porphyria. And it's in the mid-cycle, right after ovulation and the formation of the corpus luteum. So it's not at the time of menstruation, unlike so many other symptoms that are cyclical in these women. So that can certainly be a tip. Another one that we have found is a history of people report, usually to nurses more than to doctors, that my urine has been turning sort of a dark reddish. And it's amazing how rarely we as physicians get that kind of history. I think that's the kind of thing that, as you said, the nurses are spending more time actually at the bedside with the patients.
Because when they come in, what drives them to come in is the belly pain, typically. Yeah. Although, you know, we talked a little bit about in the introduction about neurologic symptoms and so on, but by far the most frequent thing that makes someone come to the emergency department for porphyria is the abdominal pain, the acute abdominal pain. And so while the doc's in there, he's doing all his normal things of when did it start, where is it, where's it located, and so on. And then that, oh, by the way, I also noticed that for a day or two before this starts or right at the same time as this starts, my urine changes color. Now, if we're all doing our job, we should ask that question, but I agree. I think nurses get a lot of the little pieces that start to add up to the picture here quite often.
Yeah. And so, Gail, in terms of the physical, as you said, as nurses, you tend to take, frankly, a more nearly complete history of medications and do the vital signs.
Right.
So what would be the typical vital signs of somebody who's having an acute porphyric attack?
Well, someone with an acute porphyric attack would have maybe tachycardia, so their elevated pulse, and they would be having systemic arterial hypertension. So we might see that with an acute attack. And also with, you know, in their labs, they sometimes have hyponatremia, which can end up leading to seizures. And also these patients can be confused. They can show some confusion and may be having hallucinations. So that's another thing that we see.
Rather ominous symptoms. Yeah. A reason to worry. What's been your experience, Dr. Risk, about bowel movements during acute porphyric attacks?
Typically, in patients who have acute porphyric attacks, they have less bowel movements. They can develop constipation. Sometimes they can actually develop an ileus-like picture, manifested by a full gamut of symptoms, including nausea and vomiting. And so, again, these things can also overlap with patients with functional abdominal pain or irritable bowel syndrome. So it's important to use other clinical clues when trying to figure out whether or not further workup needs to be performed.
Yeah, I mean, in most series, severe constipation, often to the point of obstipation, is present in around 90 to 95%, although there is a small percent that report diarrhea.
Right.
So I guess nothing's ever 100% in biology and medicine. So the exception makes the rule. All right, so we've thought about the diagnosis. It has entered our consciousness. So what is the best single test to make the diagnosis of an acute porphyria?
Of an acute porphyria, I consider a urine PBG screening test at the time of acute symptoms.
Really. Now, you didn't say porphyrins.
No. Okay. The PBG, as you did in your intro, the very specific precursor. The best test is a urine PBG screening test at the time of symptoms because, as you alluded to in the introduction, it's the precursor that accumulates because of the failed pathway. So, unfortunately, like many tests, most practicing emergency physicians do not have access to that test. It's a send-out test that then needs to be sent. Now, it can be sent out if it's kept cool and appropriately treated. You can send it out and have it tested within a few days and still be effective. But you do need to know, if you're thinking about working in an emergency room or wherever you work clinically, whether it's an emergency room or not, what test is being run. Because a lot of places will run urine porphyrins. And as we just said, that's not the test you want. It's not going to make the diagnosis for you. And if anything, it'll falsely lead people to take this one off the differential.
Dr. Risk, in your own practice, obviously it's not an emergency room setting, but maybe a little bit calmer clinical setting. How do you approach making the diagnosis? So you have the young woman who's maybe had multiple trips to the emergency room, maybe even has undergone an appendectomy, maybe had a cholecystectomy, maybe had something else done. But she's back. She's still got pain. So you think, gosh, could this be acute porphyria? What do you do?
You know, we have most of my practice is a referral-based practice. But the first thing I do ask in this type of setting is whether the patient has abdominal pain during the clinic appointment. If the patient does have abdominal pain, I like to do a rapid PPG test. Because of the fact that they're driving distances, because of the fact that oftentimes locally they don't have the test available, and it's easy enough to do and sensitive enough that were it to be negative would completely exclude the diagnosis of acute intermittent porphyria. It's interesting that we get a lot of referrals for patients who have been diagnosed with an acute porphyria who have been diagnosed, as Dr. Lander said, with the wrong type of test. And it's important to at least verify the diagnosis with a rapid PBG test in such patients, especially if they show us that the test that was performed was a measurement of a porphyrin measuring test rather than a porphobilinogen measuring test.
Now, I should just mention that there is this one very, very rare form of porphyria caused by severe deficiency of the enzyme ALA dehydratase. There have only been 7 reported cases in the entire medical literature or thereabouts, so it's very unlikely that any of us will ever see one. But that is the one form of acute porphyria in which there is not an increase in porphobilinogen. And the reason is that the site of the block is proximal to the formation of porphobilinogen. So the defect is in the inability to make porphobilinogen. But in all the other forms, as Dr. Lander has said and Dr. Risk has stressed, if somebody is having symptoms due to an acute porphyria, the urine PBG will be markedly elevated. And it won't be, you know, the upper limit of normal is 1.5 and this is 1.6. It's going to be, it's 15 or 30 or 50 milligrams per gram creatinine. It's distinctly and markedly elevated. So that is still the best test. And the biggest mistake, as again Dr. Risk said, is that somebody thought of it but did the wrong test. And there are lots and lots of disorders, conditions, not porphyria, in which there will be mild increases in urinary porphyrins, particularly in coproporphyrin. A long, long list of drugs, of other conditions that can do that. So it's very important not to jump to the diagnosis just because there's a slight abnormality in urinary porphyrins. Let's say that we've gotten the PBG test and we made the diagnosis. Gail, how do you try to counsel the patient? So here's a new patient, and we've now made the diagnosis of some form of acute porphyria. Maybe we haven't yet done the detailed genetic testing, so we don't know whether it's AIP or hereditary copro or variegate, but we're pretty confident that it is one of these acute porphyrias.
For counseling a patient, if you're sure that you have a porphyria, we want to make sure that they are aware of the dietary needs for the patient, that they would want to maintain a good regular diet, not one that's low in carbohydrates or low in calories, because those things might precipitate an attack. They would want to also avoid alcohol and stressful situations that could bring on an attack. That also they have to should have a regular an appointment with someone like you that knows about porphyria and has, should have all the genetic testing done.
Dr. Risk, what's your practice about recommending genetic testing, and how do you do it?
A patient is diagnosed with an acute porphyria. I do, because porphyrias can occur in clusters, and that's how they're oftentimes diagnosed. I often will sit down with the patient and discuss the possibility of genetic testing amongst first degree relatives. There is genetic testing that is available at one of the institutions in the United States, and I do recommend that the genetic testing and not just a urine PBG screening test be performed in those first-degree relatives.
Dr. Lander, anything to add?
The treatment for us is pretty much more of an acute thing. I mean, I think for the emergency physician or practicing clinician in the emergency room, the best thing we can do on this whole topic is to entertain the diagnosis and rule it or no, rule it out, because, as we said, these patients go years and have multiple other things done to them, some of them fairly significant, for a diagnosis that is rare but real. And if you take the time to think about it, it's not that hard to sort of start pushing yourself towards getting the simple one test to do it. Again, the key is to do the test while it's there. That being said, it brings up the interesting question of the person who actually has the diagnosis when they present to the ED, and what do we do to treat them? They come in saying, I regularly see Dr. Bonkowski down the road twice a year for this problem. I'm having one of my acute attacks. What do? I give him sugar. You know, that's the best treatment. And then
now,
you can think about giving...
Be more specific.
Usually their belly pain is accompanied with some degree of nausea, so they're not keen on eating a high carbohydrate meal. So usually we give them IV glucose. It doesn't have to be a big D50 push the way I give to a diabetic whose sugar's 19 and needs to wake up. But you give them a D10 or D25 drip over an hour or two and get their sugars up in the 200 range, 250 range by finger stick, where you know you're really driving mild hyperglycemia in that patient to help reverse the process. You also have the option of actually giving them IV heme. I've never done that in the emergency department, even in patients that were having acute symptoms, because I usually defer that to the admitting service. But I think it's certainly good to be aware of that as a therapy, so that, especially if you work in a smaller hospital or in an area where the admitting doc may not know anything about this disease process and treating it, and you could suggest to them what further treatment should be done on an inpatient basis until they get stabilized.
And Dr. Risk, why intravenous heme or hematin?
So the major issue with an acute porphyria is the induction of ALA synthase. And so there are primarily two different ways that we can use in order to downregulate that induction. One through, as Dr. Landers mentioned, glucose, and the second by negative feedback regulation by heme, which works through a variety of different methods, including reduction of RNA transcription and facilitating the breakdown of ALA synthase and other byproducts.
And Gail, from the nursing standpoint, how can the nurse help these patients the most? We doctors are great at writing orders and giving orders to nurses and so on, but then you're left having to carry them out.
Well, I think the patients probably feel a lot of frustration, and I think of providing them with emotional support. A lot of them don't know when they keep coming back to the emergency department. They don't know what's wrong with them, and they need, you know, some emotional support. And that's one way that we can certainly help them, is by giving that. And then the patient education part of this is that they need to know where to go to for help, so we can certainly refer them to American Porphyria Foundation and the Rare Disease Network, places that can give them a lot of information and support through those foundations. And then we have a lot to do with education of what drugs that are safe to take when you have porphyria and what drugs aren't safe to take. And the patient can certainly find out that information through the Porphyria Foundation as well, but we can do teaching with the patients. And it's just, there's a lot of teaching that needs to be done. As we've mentioned, diet, avoiding stressors, those are the things that I would try to support the patient with, education and emotional support.
Dr. Risk, you mentioned briefly the use of GnRH analogs, sure, particularly in these women with these cyclical attacks. Expand on that a little bit for us.
So in patients with acute porphyrias that have episodes that are worsened during the luteal phase of their menstrual period, oftentimes a GnRH analog for a period of 2 to 3 months is helpful in decreasing the number of episodes that a patient may have. Now, if the patient does have a good response to the GnRH analog, at that point you can begin to introduce a little bit of estrogen to see whether or not the patient is able to tolerate it and to see whether or not it precipitates attacks. if they're able to tolerate a little bit of estrogen at that point, then typically at that point the GnRH analog can be continued or can be stopped.
And what has been your clinical experience with how useful this form of treatment is? Have you found that most women with frequent cyclic attacks have a favorable response to these analogs?
Of course, all our experiences have been limited, given how rare AIP any of the acute porphyrias are. However, in our experience, yes, it has been helpful in reducing attacks in patients with cyclical symptoms.
And what things do we have to worry about long term? I've certainly had the experience where I've had very good responses to one of these agents. And then after 9 months, 12 months, I begin to talk to the patient about trying to stop. And sometimes I've talked them into stopping, and they've redeveloped attacks almost immediately. And they go back on, and they have a good response. So they really become unwilling to stop because they know they're going to get symptoms. So what do you then worry about if you're facing somebody that is really needs long-term GnRH analogs?
Major issue when a patient's on that medication for a long protracted period of time is inducing medical menopause. And along with that is the development of osteoporosis in these females.
So, Gail, how would you be counseling somebody who's on a GnRH analog for a long time, a patient?
So even though that these women are maybe younger and 35 or 40 years old, we have to treat them as if they are in menopause or of menopausal age, like we would someone my age that's like 50-some years old. So we would want to make sure that they have vitamin D levels checked and that they have we're on vitamin D vitamin D if we need to be, and calcium, and that the doctor's discretion that they will be having regular bone density screening and then more aggressive measures if we need to based on the results of that screening.
Okay, and so we're nearing the end, but what about long-term possible complications of the acute porphyria? So we have somebody, let's say, with well-established acute intermittent porphyria, getting older. They've had a few attacks, but they've basically done all right. What do you worry about long-term for these people?
Myself, again, mostly making the diagnosis, but we have someone who has a diagnosis. They have acute attacks. Typically, the acute attacks are severe abdominal pain, and they present like that. But long-term, we're not sure exactly all of the mechanisms, but we look for nervous system disorders. And unfortunately, you mentioned at the beginning being a great mimic. This is similar to what I sometimes tell my residents. Multiple sclerosis is a fantastic mimic because it can affect just about any part of the central nervous system in the brain and have bunch of different symptoms. This is the same thing, primarily autonomics, frequently, so they get peripheral neuropathies. Sometimes in an acute setting, it can even look like Guillain-Barré, and you can have an ascending motor paralysis, and you're off doing taps and looking for Guillain-Barré, when really maybe you should be thinking about this. But with the patient with a known diagnosis, it's primarily neuro symptoms. I think the one thing that we probably missed, again, on the ED side, is the potential psychiatric diagnosis, because there's a clear association there as well that some of this accumulation and neurodegenerative effects of long-term AIP can manifest with everything from mild depression to bipolar-like behavior or schizophrenic-like or psychotic break-like symptoms, which if you don't know about that history, can easily be misdiagnosed. But those are the things we think about long-term is the neuro manifestations, pretty much.
And Dr. Risk, from the standpoint of a gastroenterologist, what do you worry about long term in terms of possible liver disease or complications in people with known acute porphyria?
In patients who have known acute porphyria, especially if they've been treated with heme or hematin, they can develop an iron overload. Oftentimes, you know, given, and this is dependent on how often they're receiving the hematin, for every 100 milligrams of iron of IV hematin a person gets, they get about approximately 8 milligrams of iron. And it's something to be cognizant of. The patient may require a liver biopsy down the road, depending on what their total iron exposure is. Oftentimes, in patients who have severe unremitting cases of porphyria in which no medication has been helpful, there have been a few reports of liver transplantation as being helpful in patients with AIP and AHCP specifically. And so we need to remember that the acute porphyrias are not necessarily a hematologic disorder, but are a hepatologic disorder. And as a gastroenterologist, hepatologist in your community, you need to be aware of the, you know, the long-term effects in treatment with these patients, and the fact that you may be involved early on as well as down the line as well.
And I would just add to that that for not very well understood reasons, usually not due to like secondary iron overload, these people are at increased risk for developing chronic liver disease,
absolutely,
cirrhosis, and hepatocellular carcinoma.
Now, there's no official recommendation as to when to screen for HCC in these patients. However, some sort of screening should be done, either with an alpha fetoprotein, either with some sort of imaging. Again, the interval is not set, but it's something that needs to be borne in mind.
Yeah, a marked increased risk. Well, so it's time to wrap up. To summarize, acute porphyrias are a group of rare, but not unheard of, they're not unicorns, they're zebras, disorders, inherited genetic defects in normal heme synthesis. The cardinal manifestations are abdominal pain, although the pain can be in the chest, can be in the back, can be in the extremities. There can be more severe neurologic defects with usually mostly motor loss, sometimes delirium. There can be seizures. The tip-offs, as we've said, are people that keep coming back, the frequent flyers who, despite many evaluations, are having severe abdominal pain, especially with severe constipation almost all the time, tachycardia, systemic arterial hypertension, especially during attacks, history of some darkening of the urine. Those are the real tip-offs. The key test is not urinary porphyrins. It's porphobilinogen. Porphobilinogen is not a porphyrin. It's a monopyrrole, not a tetrapyrrole. You have to get porphobilinogen to make the diagnosis. It's very important to make the diagnosis early for all the reasons that we've said. It's equally as important to clearly exclude the diagnosis early so that you don't end up, as we've all seen these people that have been had ports for years, I mean, getting heme for years, have iron overload now from the heme, and they don't actually have acute porphyria. You've got to make the diagnosis right the first time. More information can be obtained from several good websites. The main one in the U.S., which is excellent, and they have a lot of educational material, the American Porphyria Foundation. A few useful references. There are many other good references. Up to Date has a good series on the porphyrias. And so thank you again, Dr. Lander, Dr. Risk, Gail Grossclose, for joining me today in this session. I think it's been a very stimulating discussion. I've certainly enjoyed it. And thank you, too, the audience, for tuning in. We do ask that you please complete the CME-CE post-test questions that follow as a measure of this continuing educational activity, along with the program evaluation form. Thanks again for attending and for your interest.
Thank you.
Thank you. thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, The Management of Acute Porphyrias, Improving Diagnosis, Treatment, and Standards of Care. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.